The bungalow she shared with Ray and Joseph was in a small, prim housing estate spread along the Niam River estuary outside the center of town. It meant a 20-minute commute to work in the morning on the tram, but the rent was relatively cheap. At night, there was just enough of a breeze coming up the estuary to keep it cool once the big archway windows were folded back. Jasmine grew up the external walls, a mass of scarlet flowers giving off a sweet scent. Denise came through the front door and dropped her little shoulder bag on the hall table. She pressed her back to the cool plaster, arching her spine and inhaling deeply. All in all, a really shitty day. The lights were on in the lounge, turned down low. When she peered in, one of the girls from the Junk Boy was lying face down on the sofa, snoring with the erratic snorts of the comatose drunk. There were muffled voices and giggles coming from Joseph's bedroom, along with familiar rhythmic sounds. Joseph, Ray, and the huge-breasted girl, energetically straining seams on the gel-foam mattress together. It would be all right, Denise thought, once she was in her own room with the door shut. From past experience, she knew the soundproofing was good enough to give her complete silence to sleep in. When she looked down at her skirt, she could see it needed spraying right away to get the wine stain out. Once she'd put it in the washing cabinet and programmed the cycle, she remembered the pile of clean laundry hurriedly dumped in the linen basket this morning, including all her other work clothes. She'd intended to do them when she got back from play school in the afternoon. So there she was at 12:15, tired and utterly miserable, standing in the kitchen in her robe, ironing her blouse for tomorrow, while the shrill whoops of other people's orgasms echoed along the hall. If there was such a thing as karma, somebody somewhere in this universe was going to get hurt bad to level this out. Chapter 3. Lawrence Newton never saw a cloud until he was 12 years old. Until then, Amethyst's light-time skies had been an unblemished azure from horizon to horizon. When the planet's orbit around its gas giant primary, Nisana, eventually propelled it into dark time and the stars came out, they would burn with a steadiness unnatural for any atmosphere, so clear was the frigid air. And with Templeton, the capital where young Lawrence lived, on the hemisphere that permanently faced away from Nisana, he never realized it was possible for anything exciting to exist overhead. In terms of landscape and environment, Amethi was crushingly boring. Nothing moved above. Nothing grew on the icy tundra. To the MacArthur Corporation, whose exploratory starship the Renfrew discovered it in 2098, such conditions were perfect. In the late 21st century, interstellar expansion was at its height, with the big companies and financial consortia funding dozens of colonies. Any planet with an oxygen-nitrogen atmosphere was being claimed and settled. But these ventures were expensive. The alien biospheres that had produced that precious blend of breathable gases were inevitably hostile and poisonous to terrestrial organisms, some immediately fatal. Establishing human communities amid such conditions was extremely costly. Not so Amethi. For all it was technically a moon, Amethi's evolution had been fairly standard for a world of its size. It started normally, with a reducing atmosphere that slowly changed as life began to emerge from primordial seas. Primitive organisms that could photosynthesize released oxygen. Carbon was consumed by new lichens and amoebas. An unremarkable cycle that was repeated across the universe wherever such conditions occurred. Evolution was progressing along standard lines until the asteroid was drawn in by Nisana's immense gravity field. 200 million years after the first primitive amoebas began fissioning, the seas were full of fish. Plants had established themselves across the land. There were big insects with thistle-down wings, and even small creatures not far removed from terrestrial amphibian genealogy. They all died in the aftermath. The impact explosion threw up enough dust and steam to obscure the entire surface. In doing so, it triggered the ultimate ice age. The glaciers that thrust out from the polar caps in the aftermath encroached farther and farther through the temperate zone until they actually merged at the equator. Seas, oceans, and lakes surrendered their water to the single mega-glacier as it continued to expand. Temperature plummeted right across the planet, combining with the water loss and darkened atmosphere to eliminate all forms of life except the most resilient bacteria. Amethi returned to an almost primordial state. But now, with a fifth of the surface covered in ice to a depth of several kilometers, and the remainder a desert that was Mars-like in its desolation, there was no potential catalyst left to precipitate change. It had become a world trapped in stasis, the isolock. For the MacArthur board members, Amethi was perfection, an existing breathable atmosphere and no indigenous life. All that was needed was a slight rise in global temperature to end the isolock and restart a normal meteorological cycle. Templeton was founded in 2115. At first, it was nothing more than a collection of prefabricated igloos with a single track linking it to a runway bulldozed into the frozen dunes. The engineers and administrators who lived there were tasked with establishing a manufacturing base that would be self-sustaining. The idea being that once the initial investment was made, all you needed to do was shovel in local raw materials at one end, and ultimately any product you wanted would pop out the other. After that, the only imports would be people and new designs to upgrade and expand the first few factories. Information cost nothing to transport between stars, while people would buy their own tickets to a new land with immense opportunities. Over the first 3 years, space planes ferried down their cargo from 8 starship flights. At the end of it, industrial facilities and heavily insulated factories could supply most of the burgeoning colony's needs. But not all. There were always a few specialist systems or chemicals essential for the economy or special projects that only Earth, with its abundant production facilities, could provide. Time after time, Templeton's governor sent back requests for additional units to be flown out, without which the whole project would stall. The financial strain that Amethi placed on MacArthur wasn't as bad as that for most other colony worlds, where human biochemists fought desperate battles against alien biospheres. Here, there was just Heat Smash, the climate project, to initiate. Templeton's first indigenous industrial undertaking was to establish an orbital manufacturing station, Tarona. With that up and running in 2140, after nearly a third of its systems had been shipped in from Earth, they began local production of asteroid capture propulsion engines. Nisana had so much junk rock strewn around in orbit, it could have provided Heat Smash with enough material to reheat a dozen worlds. The inaugural impact came in 2142, when a lump of stony iron rock measuring 80 meters across smacked right into the center of Barclay's glacier. The explosion vaporized nearly a cubic kilometer of water and melted a considerably larger quantity. It had refrozen within a week. The steam clouds never even reached the edge of the glacier before they condensed into bullet-hard snowflakes and rained down. Once the planetary engineers had correlated all the data from their sensors, they estimated that the atmosphere would have reheated sufficiently to induce and sustain glacial melt after 111 years of one impact per year, involving asteroids 4 times the mass of the test impact. With this mildly favorable prognosis, the colonists set about building their new world. By the time Lawrence Newton was born in 2310, economic and social changes on the old homeworld had modified the nature of the colony. Although the physical task of terraforming the world had progressed without interruption, it was no longer a destination for exultant pioneers searching for a little homestead amid a wilderness that was slowly being resurrected. The big school bus rolled easily along Templeton's main north highway, fat tires clinging to the grubby concrete with its lacework of fine cracks. 25 kids, aged 9 to 12, chattered excitably or threw crumpled biscuit wrappers at each other before ducking down behind their seats to avoid retaliation. Mr. Kaufman and Ms. Ridley, their teachers, sat up at the front, doing their best to ignore what was going on behind. They left the school dome only 10 minutes ago. It was going to be a long day. Lawrence was sitting midway along the bus. The seat next to him went unoccupied. It wasn't that he didn't have friends at school. He did, as well as several cousins and a tribe of more distant relatives. He just didn't have any close friends. Teachers described him as restless. He was clever enough, naturally, given he was a Newton, but that intelligence was never quite captured by any of his academic subjects. Report after report filed with his parents had the age-old comment, "Can do better." In the competitive environment of the school, where application and achievement received the highest accolades, he was too different to fit in comfortably. Not quite a rebel, he was still too young for that classification, but there were plenty of danger signs that he could fall into the dropout category if something wasn't done fairly soon. It was an almost unknown development among Amathai's well-ordered population. For a member of a bored family, it was unthinkable. So he sat by himself, ignoring the antics of his peers, watching the city go by outside. On either side of the highway were drab, curving walls of nullthene, huge sheets of the ultra-thin, translucent gray membrane from which the city domes were made. The standard size was 400 meters across, produced in one piece by the MacArthur factory, and wholly indigenous. Relatively cheap and simple to establish, it was used by every town and city on the planet. All you needed was a flat patch of land over which to spread it. The sheet had a built-in hexagonal web of slim tubing made from bucky filament carbon, extruded up at Torona, that was pumped full of epoxy. The resultant force was enough to lift the lightweight nullthene off the ground like some giant balloon that never quite managed to become airborne. The edges had to be buried hurriedly, as the membrane's molecular structure had been designed to act as a near-perfect heat trap. Air inside quickly warmed to temperate and even tropical temperatures, exerting quite a lifting pressure from within. Large circulation and thermal exchange units, also built locally, were installed around the edge, helping to maintain the required climate inside. Once the dome was up and regulated, all that was needed to reinvigorate the soil was water and terrestrial bacteria, and it was ready for planting. Right at the heart of the city, most of the domes were communal. Above average in size, at 600 meters in diameter, they had a single apartment block skyscraper in the center, acting as an additional support for the vaulting surface. Inside, rich parkland had been established around the skyscrapers, complete with artificial lakes and streams. Nobody outside top-level management used cars to get about within the city. The domes were all linked by a comprehensive rail transit network. The only vehicles on the road with the school bus were 20-wheel juggernauts, agriform machinery, and civil engineering trucks, all of them cheerfully pumping high hydrogen fuel fumes out into the atmosphere. Factories filled the gaps between the dome rims, squat bunkers built from glass and aluminum. Incrustations of dust streaked the big panes, built up over years as heat and moisture creeping out of the city structures loosened up the frozen ground. Even here, the air suffered as it did in every human city, a pollution of particles and vapor that hadn't known freedom for 100,000 years, churned up by the whirling zephyrs thrown off by the trains and road vehicles and dome circulation fans. For decades, the only wind on the whole planet. But it allowed plants to flourish. All along the side of the road, Lawrence could see tufts of dark green grass clogging the ruddy native soil. There were even little fissures where free water had on occasion run, fed by trickles of condensation along badly insulated panels or tattered slits in the nullthene. Farther out from the city center, food refineries began to replace the domes. Industrial sites the size of small towns where pressure tanks and enzyme breeder towers and protein convectors were woven together with a maze of thick insulated pipes. Hot vapors shivered the air for hundreds of meters above the dulled metal surfaces, as small fusion plants pumped their megawatts into the elaborate processes that kept Amathai's human population alive. Each refinery had its own quarry, huge vertical-walled craters gouged deep into the frozen soil by AS-driven bulldozers. Caravans of big utility trucks trundled up and down the pitside ramps all day long, bringing hundreds of tons of elusive rare minerals to the catalytic furnaces. The Trans-Ratcliffe Basin pipe ended somewhere on this side of the city, too. It stretched a quarter of the way around the planet to the Barclays Glacier runoff, bringing that essential component of life, water. It was actually cheaper to pump it in than to melt it out of local soil. Both the domes and the refineries were greedy customers. Lawrence watched the various human enterprises that made up the city with detached interest, visualizing how Templeton and its peripherals must look from space. Some weird plastic flower, 70 kilometers in diameter, that had blossomed on this barren alien world as the atmosphere warmed. One day it would burst, the Nulthine membranes ripping open in the wind, so that the terrestrial spawn nurtured within could be flung out across the entire planet. Only with that kind of image did he ever begin to appreciate the enormity of the undertaking that was his home world. It was the endless statistics and enhanced images that he could never get his head around, everything the school felt impelled to provide and emphasize. Out past the last of the refineries, the tundra extended away to the sharp horizon, dirty vermilion soil broken only by rocks and ancient crumbling gullies. Swaths of darkness cut through it at random. When Barclay's glacier formed, sucking the moisture out of the air and sending the temperature plummeting, the forests were still standing. Their trees had long since died from the cold and lack of light, but the slumbering glacier calmed the air rather than enraging it. There were no winds or sandstorms to abrade the sturdy trunks. The scatterings of moisture left in the soil turned to ice, transforming the surface into a hard concrete mantle, keeping a possessive grip on sand and dust particles. In the centuries after the glacier formed, Amethyst's dead, blackened plants stayed resolutely upright in the still air. Time alone aged them, for there were no elements anymore. Over 100,000 years, even petrified wood lost its strength. They corroded slowly, snowing ebony flakes onto the surrounding soil, until enough had been shed to make the whole unstable. Then the entire brittle pillar would crack, tumbling over to shatter as if made from antique black glass. More often than not, in the denser forests, they would bring down a couple of their neighbors, initiating cascades of devastation. Where the forests once stood were now areas where the soil was blanketed with low black dunes of congealed grit. The children quietened at last as this new landscape unwound beyond the bus. Here was where their future was birthing with pained deliberation. The first delicate effects of the heat smash were proudly visible. Crevices and tiny rills in the hard ground were host to tiny Arctic plants. They were all heavily V-written for this world, to endure not only its coldness but also the long light times and dark times. Plants that grew above Earth's Arctic Circle, through long, wearisome days and equally oppressive nights, had the closest environmental conditions to those on Amethyst. This meant their genes needed the least amount of viral modification to withstand the hostility of this frigid wilderness. Several of them boasted flowers, tiny, dainty coral trumpets or golden starbursts. The most significant accomplishment of the geneticists had been modifying the pollination cycle, so that the spores were expelled by ripening anthers into the quiescent air. A haze light enough to drift on Amethyst's minimalist breezes, little more than a draft of perfume, yet eradicating the necessity of insects. None of these perennials had needed nurturing in greenhouses and planting out. They were self-set, the first naked terrestrial colonists. While dark bottle greens flourished in the earth's crannies, dry rubber blotches of sulfur yellow and cinnamon brown encrusted exposed rock, from entire cliff faces down to pebbles, scattered amid the carbon dunes of the old forests. The lichens that were first spread across Amethyst continents from high-flying robot aircraft in order to kickstart the new ecological cycle expanded now as never before in the rush of warmth and rising humidity. Lawrence liked the color invasion stampeding across the bleak tundra. It signaled an astonishing level of achievement. Fundamentally reassuring, that human beings were capable of such visionary endeavor. He began to smile, letting his daydreams build out of the landscape where the impossible was happening. It was easy out here. The demands of his family and school restrictions were falling behind as the bus raced on into the realm of possibilities. His gaze drifted around and up. He squinted, suddenly alert. Hot, urgent hands wiped the bus window where his breath was steaming it up, despite the insulative quality. There, in the sky, something very strange was moving. He knocked on the glass to try to show people where they should look. Then, realizing nobody would ever listen to him, he put his hand up above the window and found the red emergency handle. Without hesitating, he tugged it down hard. Anti-skid brakes engaged as the AS driver program brought the bus to a halt as fast as its engineering parameters would allow. A signal was flashed to the Templeton Traffic Authority, putting emergency services on immediate recovery standby. Sensors inside and outside the vehicle were reviewed for any sign of abnormality. Nothing was found, but the human manual intervention was not one the AS could ignore. The bus continued its abrupt deceleration, engine and gearbox whining sharply in mechanical alarm. Kids were hauled back hard in their seats as the safety webbing contracted. Yells and screams ran the length of the aisle. Mr. Kaufman lost hold of his coffee cup and biscuit as he cried, "Fate's bloody sake!" A second later, the bus was motionless and silent, a state almost as alarming as the sudden braking. Then the horn started a repetitive bleat, and amber hazard strobes on the front and back blazed away. Mr. Kaufman and Ms. Ridley gave each other a frantic, uncomprehending look and slapped at their web release buttons. The red light above one of the emergency's top handles was flashing urgently. Mr. Kaufman never got a chance to ask whose seat it was before Lawrence was running past him to the front door, which had popped open automatically. The boy was zipping up the front of his baggy coat.
"What?"
Ms. Ridley blurted.
"It's outside," Lawrence yelled. "In the air. It's in the air." "Wait!"
She was yelling at nothing. He had already jumped down the steps onto the highway. The other kids wanted a piece of the action. They were laughing wildly, shock already fading as they dashed after Lawrence. They formed a big group standing on the sandy verge. Coats were hurriedly zipped up and hands stuffed into gloves as the bitter air nipped exposed skin. Lawrence stood a little way ahead of them, searching around for the bizarre shape he'd seen. There were several titters behind him as the weight grew.
"There," he shouted. His finger pointed westward. "There, look."
The rebuke Mr. Kaufman had been forming died away. A patch of tufty white cloud was floating serenely through the air, the only blemish in a perfectly bright azure sky. Silence fell over the kids as they watched the implausible miracle.
"Sir, why doesn't it fall?"
Mr. Kaufman stirred himself. "Because the density is equal to the air at that altitude."
"But it's solid."
"No," he smiled. "It just looks like it is. Remember when we looked at Nisana through the telescope relay and you could see the clouds that made up the storm bands? They were flowing. This is the same, but a lot smaller."
"Does that mean there are going to be storms here, sir?"
"Eventually, yes. But don't worry, they'll be a lot smaller, too."
"Where did it come from?"
"Barclay's Glacier, I suppose. You've all seen the pictures of the runoff. This is one of the results. You're going to be seeing a lot more as you grow up." He let them stare at the Harbinger for a while longer, then shooed them back onto the bus. Lawrence was last up the steps, reluctant to abandon his remarkable discovery. And there was also the inevitable censure to face. The teachers were a lot more lenient than he expected. Ms. Ridley said she understood how strange the cloud was, but he must ask permission to ever do anything like that again. Mr. Kaufman gave a gruff nod, enforcing everything she said. Lawrence went and sat down as the bus moved forward again. The rest of the kids forgot their games to chatter in an animated fashion about what they'd just seen. Already, this was the best ecology field trip ever. Lawrence joined in occasionally with a few observations and speculations, his discovery giving him kudos previously not experienced. Mainly, though, he tried to keep tracking the cloud through the bus window.
He couldn't stop thinking about the journey it had made. Traveling halfway around the world, with so much unknown territory laid out below it. How ridiculous that a cloud had seen more of Amathai than he ever had. Lawrence wanted to be up there with it, soaring over the land and empty seabeds, swooping down to zoom along the crumbling edge of Barclay's glacier, where he could see the runoff, a waterfall as long as a continental shoreline. How fabulous that would be. But here he was, stuck in a bus on his way to a poxy slow life farm, learning about ecology when at some other school he could be learning how to fly. It just wasn't fair. The slow life farm was, like all Amathai's industrial facilities, an uninspiring glass and aluminum box. It was situated all by itself on the side of a gentle valley, with an empty river course meandering away below it. The Arctic plants were particularly prolific along the low slopes, clustering thickly on the silt bed itself. Several of the kids remarked on it when they scuttled from the bus to the warmth of the factory. Lawrence was still trying to see the cloud, which had disappeared off to the north some time ago. The lobby's big outer doors swung shut, and a gust of air washed over the group. They'd all been expecting that. The thermal trap lobby was standard across Amathai, a giant leaky airlock arrangement with thermal recyclers instead of vacuum pumps to prevent temperature drop in the domes. Here there didn't seem much point. The factory was nothing like as warm as any of the city domes, barely a couple of degrees above freezing. They all kept their coats sealed up. The supervisor came out to meet them, dressed in padded purple coveralls with a tight-fitting hood. Mrs. Segan, who with her three co-workers ran the whole operation. She tried hard not to show how annoyed she was with another bunch of kids touring around and screwing up her timetable. "What you're going to see here today has no analog in nature," she told them, as they made their way into the building. This first zone seemed more factory than farm, with dark metal corridors lined with sealed glass windows that looked in on vats of some kind. "We grow fatworms here. I'd like to say breed, but the truth is every one of these creatures is cloned." She stopped beside a window. The room beyond was filled with racks of trays filled with a clotted jelly similar to frog spawn. "All slow life is completely artificial. Its DNA was designed for us by the Fell Institute in Oxford, back on Earth. As you know, the more complex an organism is, the more prone to illness and other problems it becomes. Therefore, fatworms are kept very simple indeed. The principal biological streamlining is their complete lack of reproductive ability. That's also very useful to us, as they are only needed for this stage of the terraforming process. They've got a lifetime of about 10 years, so when we stop making them, they'll die out." She held up a jar of the jelly substance, handing it to the closest boy. "Pass that around, and please don't breathe on it. All slow life is optimized to function at sub-zero temperature. Your breath is like a flame to them." When it came to Lawrence, all he could see was a mass of translucent eggs with a pinhead of darkness at the center of each. They didn't quiver or shake about as if they were about to burst open, which would have been something. Boring. Mrs. Segan took them through into the farm's main rearing arena. A long hall with rows of big rectangular plastic boxes separated by raised metal grid walkways. Pipes overhead sprayed gloopy fluid into each of the open boxes with short, regular pulses. The air smelled of crushed grass and sugar. "Each of the fatworms is essentially a miniature bacteria reactor," Mrs. Segan said as she led them along one of the walkways. "We placed them on a new section of tundra, and they burrow their way through the ground, chewing the dead vegetable matter in the soil. When it comes out, it's suffused with the bacteria that lives in their gut. This prepares the ground for terrestrial plants, which all need the bacteria in the soil to live on." The kids all leaned over the side of the box she indicated, their interest suddenly regained with the prospect of creatures that could poo out fungus and stuff. A glistening mass of oyster-gray fatworms covered the bottom of the box, squirming slowly. They were about 15 centimeters long, a couple wide. Everyone oohed and yucked as they pulled rictus grimaces at the slimy mini-monsters. Is that why they're called slow life? Someone asked. 'Cause they don't move fast?
Partly, Mrs. Segan said. The temperature they encounter outside means they don't have a particularly fast metabolism, which makes their physical motion correspondingly slow. Their blood is based on glycerol, so they can keep moving through the coldest ground without freezing solid. Lawrence sighed impatiently as she droned out long statistics, then started to explain about other slow life forms. Some were like fish, swimming in the snow slush runoff rivers around Barclay's Glacier. Others were distant relatives of caterpillars, munching their way across the huge dunes of carbon granules left behind by Amethyst's original forests. He glanced down into the big box again. It was a bunch of worms wriggling around sluggishly. So what? Who in fate cared what grubbed around under the soil? Why didn't they come up with birds or something interesting? Dinosaurs, maybe. Mrs. Segan moved on, the group buzzing along behind her. Lawrence trailed at the rear. He craned his neck back, looming through the farm's grimy glass roof to see if the cloud had returned. The next thing he knew, he tripped on some ridge in the walkway and went flailing onto his back. One scrabbling hand caught a shallow plastic bin, and when he landed painfully, a whole bunch of fully grown fatworms were dropping on top of him. He rolled away from them quickly, disgust overriding the pain along his jarred spine. These adults were some 40 centimeters long, 7 or 8 in diameter. Their tips waved about blindly. Lawrence clambered to his feet, automatically checking the position of the teachers. Nobody had actually seen him fall. He looked down at the fatworms, the only evidence. Gingerly telling himself they weren't in the slightest bit dangerous, he groped down and tried to pick one up. It was revoltingly cold and slimy, with a texture like sodden carpet, but he managed to grip it tight. As he lifted it up, the slight wavering motion began to speed up. Instead of putting it back in the bin, he held on and watched. After a while, the fat worm was almost thrashing. He dropped it back down onto the floor, and it slithered off along the walkway. There was a claret-colored patch around its midsection where his hand had been. All right, he murmured. Not so slow after all. Which was logical. They were slow in the cold, therefore they'd be fast in the warmth. He scuttled after the group. Alan, he hissed. Hey, Alan, come and look at this. Alan Cramley stopped munching on his Toby bar, curious about the furtive tone. What? Lawrence took him back to the adult fatworms and showed him. They quickly turned the discovery into a challenge. Pick up the fatworms in tandem and hold them for 30 seconds, then drop them on the walkway and see which reaches the end of the grid first. In the end, they were holding on to 2 each, turning it into a real race. What exactly is going on here? Mr. Kaufman demanded. Lawrence and Alan hadn't seen him approach from a walkway intersection. He was staring down at the 4 fat worms twisting their way across the metal. Several of the other kids were behind him, and Mrs. Segan was scurrying up, anxious to see what the fuss was about. I knocked a bin over, sir, and we were trying to pick them up, Lawrence said, holding out his icy hands as proof. Slime dripped from white, cold, crinkled fingertips. I'm really sorry. Mr. Kaufman was frowning, not fully convinced. Don't touch them, Mrs. Segan called urgently. She slipped past Mr. Kaufman, pulling on a pair of thick gauntlets. Remember what I told you about them being adapted to the cold? Lawrence and Alan traded a look. Mrs. Segan picked up the first fat worm. Her eyes narrowed as she took in the big red mark around its middle. She took it over to the nearest bin. What have you done? She yelled. All the fat worms inside had the same red mark. None of them were moving. She hurried to the next bin and gasped. In the third bin, there were some fat worms left undulating slowly. Lawrence and Alan hadn't raced all of them yet. She whirled around. Lawrence took a step back, afraid she'd strike him. Her face was rigid with fury. You burned them all, you little... She turned to Mr. Kaufman. Tour's over. Get these brats out of here. Lawrence had taken over the robot garage several years ago.
The compact tract machines that originally tended to the elaborate gardens of his family's domes had been replaced by newer, more efficient models when they upgraded their AS groundskeeper program. He'd found the old concrete ramp in the middle of a clump of copper-flowering bushes that had been allowed to expand and merge into a shaggy wall. Now the entrance was no longer needed. At the base of the ramp was a swing-up door with stiff old lever arms. It took a commendable amount of effort and persistence for a 9-year-old to prize it open, but Lawrence did it, to be rewarded with a musty concrete cave stretching out ahead of him for a good 10 meters. Its roof was less than 2 meters from the ground, and it had strange metal tracks bolted to the floor, walls, and ceilings, where Waldo Arms had once run. But there was still power and a data node. Since then, it had become his den. He'd moved in life's essentials, cluttering it with a dilapidated magenta-colored leather settee, piles of cushions, a couple of tables, an old model desktop Pearl, a sound system with a decibel level that most hard rock bands would envy, 2 active memory towers his father had salvaged from the office for him, an eclectic array of tools and boxes of toys he never played with. He'd tacked sheet screens over the walls and even part of the ceilings. A mosaic of images played as soon as the door was opened, some from the memory towers, while others broadcast live camera feeds from the data pool. It was a grand refuge from his family and the rest of Amathai. Even his 4 younger siblings knew to stay out unless he explicitly invited them in. He'd gone there as soon as he got back after the ecology field trip. The sheet screens were showing several images of Templeton from cameras mounted on the apex of various domes. One of them showed Nisana's bright crescent, relayed from a nearside school's astronomy department telescope. Another was a telescope tracking Barik, the 3rd largest moon. Lawrence told the desktop Pearl to find a spaceport feed and switch it to the biggest sheet screen, the one hanging opposite the sofa, which took up half the wall. The camera must have been sighted on the control tower. It showed the thick gray runway stabbing out across the bleak, rusty-colored tundra. Nothing was landing or taking off. "Get me a Flight Horizon episode," he instructed the Pearl. "Which one?" its AS program asked. "Doesn't matter. No, wait. Series 1, Episode 5. Creation 5. I want third person with the edit I chose last time. Put it on the big screen and close down the others." He flopped into the settee and stuck his feet up on the armrest. The remaining sheet screens blacked out. Right in front of him, the credits started to roll, and the soundtrack kicked in, making the thin screens tremble. He'd found Flight Horizon 2 years ago when he sent an ask ping through the catalogs of Amathai's multimedia companies. As far as he was concerned, it was the greatest science fiction series ever made. Not fully I, but it allowed personae selection so the episode could be viewed from any of the principal characters' viewpoints. And it wasn't educational, like all of Amathai's eye dramas aimed at the youth audience. Set hundreds of years in the future, it featured the amazingly cool starship Ultima, which had been sent to explore a section of the spiral arm halfway around the galaxy from Earth. Several of the crew were alien, and the weird planets they visited were superbly scary. They were also facing some awesome evil aliens, the Delexians, who wanted to prevent them from getting home. It had been imported from Earth 30 years ago, though the copyright was 2287. There were only 30 episodes in the multimedia company's library, and Lawrence knew them so well now he could almost recite the dialogue from memory. He couldn't believe that was all that had been made. The Earth data pool address of the show's fan club was tagged in the expanded features menu of every episode, so he'd paid a Starship carriage fee and sent them a text message asking for more information. Every time a starship arrived back at Amathai, he checked its communication AS, but they never sent him a reply. The Ultima was locked in a gigantic energy battle against a blue dwarf star that the Delexians had imprinted with a sentience matrix when a green priority script icon opened in the center of the sheet screen. The starship froze and the script scrolled down. "Lawrence, please come to your father's study. He checked the clock. 5:45. His father had been back home 10 minutes. Mr. Kaufman hadn't wasted any time filing his report package. "Give me the study, Pearl," he said to the den's A.S. "I have it online," the A.S. said. "I'm busy right now," Lawrence said. He pushed some injured annoyance into the tone. The A.S., running in the study's desktop Pearl, was smart. "Lawrence, please. I accessed the message from your school and prioritized it. Your father wants to see you now." He kept silent. "Do you want me to bring your father into this conversation on real time?" "All right," grudgingly. "I'm coming, I suppose. But you have to explain to the school A.S. why my home study is short tonight." "You're not doing home study." "I am. I just have Flight Horizon on as background." Lawrence swung the garage door shut behind him and wriggled through the bushes. The garage was near the rim of the main dome, which was approaching the end of summer. There were 6 of the big structures making up the Newton family estate, the large one in the center with its temperate climate, and 5 smaller ones ringing it, each with a different environment inside. It was one of the larger estates in the Ruiza district, which was where the capital's wealthiest citizens clustered. He had a 300-meter walk across the grounds to the house itself. The landscape designer had gone in for split levels, with a chessboard of English manor lawns walled in with near-vertical borders of flowering shrubs and perennials. Each lawn was themed with classical plants. One had roses, one with fuchsia. Another had begonias, magnolias, hydrangeas, delphiniums. For variety, several lawns were enclosed by rockeries spouting dozens of alpines. 2 serpentine pools led away into shallow rocky cascades with reeds and lilies sprouting from outcrops and shelves in the slope. Tall trees stood above the corner of every lawn, again selected for a traditional appearance: willow, spruce, birch, horse chestnut, larch. Each of them had had boughs that drooped either naturally or by judicious shaping, forming massive, verdant skirts that swept the grass. Fabulous adventure caves for small children. Lawrence had enjoyed a lot of summers playing in the gardens, as his siblings did now. A stream ran through the dome, a rough horseshoe shape around the outside of the formal lawns, where the grass was permitted to grow shaggy and daisies and forget-me-nots flourished. He crossed over a narrow, moss-cloaked humpback bridge and walked the flagstone path to the house, going up or down steps at the end of each square lawn. Ahead of him, the Newton residence was a stately home built from a yellow stone, with big bay windows protruding from walls swarmed by honeysuckle. Several peacocks strutted around on the gravel path surrounding the house, long folded tails swishing the pebbles about. Their mad, penetrating cackle cry was virtually the only sound in the dome. They scattered as Lawrence crossed the path and made his way up the steps to the front door. The entrance hall inside was cool. Heavy polished oak doors opened into the formal ground floor rooms. Their furnishings and decorations were all exquisite antique pieces. Lawrence hated them. He was frightened to go into any of the rooms for fear of breaking some priceless chunk of the family's precious heritage. What was the point of having a house like this? Nobody could use it properly, not like the real homes some of his schoolmates had. It cost a fortune to build, and it didn't belong on Amathai anyway. This was how people used to build. It was the past. A wooden staircase curved up to the 2nd-floor landing. He trotted up it, his footfalls absorbed by the dark crimson carpet. His mother was standing at the top, holding 2-year-old Veronica on her hip. She gave him a worried look. But then that was Mother, always worried about something. His little sister smiled brightly and held out her hands to him. He grinned and kissed her. "Oh, Lawrence," his mother said. Her voice carried a unique tone of despair and disapproval that always made him lower his head. It was awful not being able to look at his own mother. And now he'd upset her again, which was a terrible thing because she was 6 months pregnant. It wasn't that he didn't want another brother or sister, but pregnancy always tired her so much. Whenever he said anything, she smiled bravely and said it was why she had married his father, to continue the family line. Family. Everything was for the family.
Is he really cross? Lawrence asked.
We're both disappointed with you. It was a dreadful thing to do. Imagine treating Beryl like that.
Beryl was one of the family dogs, a shaggy black Labrador, Lawrence's favorite out of the pack that roamed around the house. They'd grown up together.
It's not the same, he protested. They're just worms.
I'm not arguing with you. Go and see your father.
With that, she turned her back on him and started down the stairs. Veronica gurgled happily, waving.
Lawrence waved back forlornly and walked slowly to the study. The door was open. He knocked on the wooden frame. Christina was just coming out, the new junior nanny for the Newton children. She gave Lawrence a sly wink, which lifted his spirits considerably. Christina was 21 and utterly beautiful. He often wondered if he had a crush on her, but wasn't sure how you knew. He certainly thought about her a lot, if that's what qualified. Anyway, crushes were stupid. Beauty aside, it was great when she was on duty. She was fun, and she joined in the games his brothers and sisters played. And she didn't seem to mind what he got up to or how late to bed he was. All his siblings liked her as well, which was fortunate because she wasn't a whole load of use when it came to changing diapers and preparing food and things. Pity she wasn't on duty more often. Like the rest of the house, the study wasn't for the use of children. There was a high marble fireplace that had never seen any flames other than the holographic variety, a couple of green leather reading chairs. You had to look hard to see any accommodation to modern technology. The two largest oil paintings were actually sheet screens, and the desk diary was a case for a pane. The walls were covered in bookcases holding leather-bound volumes. Lawrence would have loved to open up some of the classics, definitely not the poetry, and read what was inside, but they weren't books to be read, just to be looked at and assigned high dollar values.
Shut the door, his father ordered. Sighing, Lawrence did as he was told.
His father was sitting behind the walnut veneer desk, throwing a silver dance paperweight from hand to hand. He was Doug to his friends, and a lot of people in Templeton fought over gaining that classification. In his mid-40s, though his extensive germline V-writing made it difficult to tell. With a lean build and a face to which smiling came easy, he could have passed for 25 without too much problem. Rivals on MacArthur's board had mistaken that smile for an easygoing nature, an assumption they never repeated.
All right, he said. I'm not going to shout at you, Lawrence. At your age, it's just a waste of time. You just curl up into a sulk and let it all wash over you. If I didn't know better, I'd say you were hitting puberty.
Lawrence blushed furiously. This wasn't what he was expecting, which was probably why his father was talking in such a fashion.
Want to tell me what happened today?
I was just messing about, Lawrence said, making sure there was plenty of regret in his voice. They were only worms. I didn't know getting them hot could kill them. I didn't mean to do it.
Only worms. Hmm.
Doug Newton stopped throwing the paperweight and stared at the ceiling as if lost in deep thought.
That would be the same fat worms that are vital for preparing our ecology, would it?
Yes, but they clone millions of them in there every day.
The paperweight was tossed between his hands again. That's not the point, son. This is just the latest episode in a very long line.
You're 12. I can put up with you misbehaving and slacking off at school. It comes naturally at your age. That's why teachers send us reports, so we can make you do your home study and ground you when you pee on the security cameras at the museum. What I don't like is the pattern that's developing here. Lawrence, you show a disturbing lack of respect for everything we're doing on this world. It's as if resurrecting the ecology doesn't matter to you. Don't you want to be able to walk outside the domes in just a T-shirt and shorts? Don't you want to see grass bloom on the deserts and watch forests grow?
Of course I do. He was still smarting over the peeing remark. He hadn't known his father had heard about that.
Then why don't you show that? Why don't your actions betray these thoughts? Why are you being such a total pain in the ass these days, and incidentally upsetting your mother, who happens to be pregnant and is in no condition to be worried by your absurd antics.
I do think it. I saw a cloud today.
And pulled the emergency stop on the bus. Yes, most impressive.
It was fantastic. I really loved that part of the ecology.
Well, that's a start, I suppose.
It's just, I know how important heat smash is for Amathai, and I really admire everything MacArthur is doing here, but it doesn't apply to me as much as it does to you.
Doug Newton caught the paperweight in his left hand and stared at Lawrence, quirking an eyebrow. As I recall, we had you V-written for an improved physique and intellect. I don't recall specifying traits that allow you to live naked and alone on an unmodified, isolocked planet. In fact, I'm pretty sure about that.
But, Dad, I don't want to live on Amathai, at least not all the time, he added hurriedly. I want to be a part of MacArthur's Starflight operations.
Oh, shit. Lawrence's jaw dropped. He'd never heard his father swear before. He knew now he must be in some pretty deep, well, shit.
Starflight operations? Doug Newton said. Has this got anything to do with that stupid show you're always watching?
No, Dad. I watch Flight Horizon because it interests me. It's just a drama show. But that's the kind of thing I want to do. I know I can qualify. I'm doing well on all the subjects you need to get into flight training. I've accessed the application packages and the career structure.
Lawrence, we're a board family. Don't you understand that? I sit on MacArthur's board. Me, your dear old father. I make the decisions when it comes to running this entire planet. That's your future, son. Maybe I haven't emphasized that enough. Maybe I shied away so that you'd grow up as normally as you can, without always having that prospect gnawing away at the back of your mind. But that's the way it is, and I think deep down you know it full well. Maybe that's what's upsetting you. Well, I'm sorry, son, but you're a crown prince in this bright new land of ours. It's not easy, but you gain a hell of a lot more than you lose.
I can come back and be a board member. Captaining a starship will be the best sort of training for that.
Lawrence!
Doug Newton stopped himself and groaned.
Why do I feel like I'm telling you Father Christmas doesn't exist?
Listen to me. I can see how flying a starship looks like the greatest thing ever.
Well, it's not, okay? You go from Amathai to Earth, and then Earth back to here. And that's it. 6 weeks locked up in a pressurized module with other people's farts and no window. Even calling the staff crew members is a polite lie. People on starships either interface with an AS or their mechanics trained in free-fall engineering maintenance techniques. You can interface with an AS here in safety and comfort from an office or a park seat. If you do it from a starship cabin for any length of time, your body will suffer. We've got good medicines to cope when your bones thin, your heart muscle decays, and your head clogs with every body fluid in existence. They can just about get you through a flight without thinking of suicide. God knows enough of us have done it. I hated going to Earth and back. I was throwing up half the time. I bounced around so much I had more bruises than stepping into a boxing ring can ever give you. And it's impossible to sleep. But a trip back to Earth is a one shot. People can endure that. If you stay up there 10 or 15 years, even with long planet leave periods, the effects are cumulative. That's just the ordinary damage. It's also a high radiation risk profession. Cosmic radiation will tear your DNA to shreds. And all this is the good job. I'm not even going to mention what'll happen to you if you become an engineer who has to go spacewalking. If you think I'm joking or painting it blacker than it really is, just look up the death rates and life expectancy among crew members. I'll get you access to MacArthur's classified personnel files if you want to do it.
That's not the kind of starflight I'm interested in, Dad. I want to join a starship on a deep exploration mission.
Really?
Lawrence didn't like the look of his father's amused smile. It implied some kind of victory.
Yes. Find new planets to colonize, make first contact with a sentient alien race, that kind of thing?
Yes.
When you trawled up MacArthur's application form for starship crew, did you bother to look up which of our starships are dedicated to interstellar exploration? It's in the same information block.
It doesn't say. That part of operations is all run from Earth.
He watched his father's smile widen.
Isn't it?
Nothing is run from Earth, son. Not since 2285. In any case, MacArthur canceled all interstellar exploration missions in 2230. We haven't flown one since. Not one. Know why?
Lawrence didn't believe what he was hearing. It was all part of some fancy ploy to make him study harder at school or something.
No. Too expensive. Starships cost a fortune to build and a fortune to run, and I do mean fortune. We got nothing in return for scouting around this section of the galaxy. It's an investment black hole.
We got Amethi.
Ah, at last, some pride in your home planet. Yes, we got Amethi. We also got Anyi, Adark, and Alagon. That's what 2285 was all about. We had to get rid of them. Colonization costs money that shareholders on Earth will never see a return on. We're never going to make a commercial consumer product and ship it over interstellar distances and sell it for less than it costs to be produced locally. Investment must come from Earth. There was no way MacArthur could fund four planets, so we sold three of them to Kyushu RV and Hyzark Interstellar Holdings in merger deals. That canceled a huge part of the debt we were running up. And in parallel with that, we divested some other assets to holding companies and reassigned share ownership of the core company to Amethi residents. It was quite innovative, really. Several other companies copied us later. The result is that 58% of MacArthur's shares are owned by Amethi residents. The company on Earth, with all its factories and financial services, now exists for one thing, to fund Amethi. It also offers Earth-based shareholders the eventual dividend of emigration. It's like the ultimate benefits and pension scheme.
But there's so much out there in space we need to see and understand.
No, there isn't, son, his father said firmly. Government space agencies sent ships to just about every kind of star there was to collect data right back at the start of the interstellar age. We've examined every stellar anomaly within range and found more planets than the human race can afford to exploit. We've been out there and done it all. That's over now. This is the time when we benefit from all that knowledge and effort and expense. It's our golden age. Enjoy it.
I'll go to another company, then. Join their starship program.
Hello? This is Universe calling Lawrence. Did you not hear everything I just said?
Son, nobody is exploring anything anymore. There is nothing left to explore.
That's why your school concentrates on the courses you'll need to manage Amethi. You have to know what's required to complete the terraforming project. Your future is here, and I want you to start focusing on that right now. So far, I've been tolerant of all this misbehavior, but it ends today. It's time you started measuring up to this family's expectations.
Chapter 4. The world had been chosen by the last church to site its supreme temple because it was close to the Ulidan Nebula, which was remarkable for its darkness. Normally, nebulas can be the most glorious of all stellar objects. They're bunched up, twisted cyclones of gas and dust that measure light years across, so big they often have several stars inside. The light from those stars makes them glow, fluorescing the dust and vapor into a blaze of scarlet or violet or emerald, but not the Ulidan. The Ulidan was mostly made up from carbon dust, as black as the gulf between galaxies. There were stars inside, including one very famous one that was home to the Mordif, but they were all invisible from outside. There was no glow, not even a glimmer. The Ring Empire called it the Cloud of the Dead, especially after their explorer ship found the Mordif planet. For the last church, it was perfect. Standing on their planet and looking up into the sky, the Ulidan eclipsed half of the core suns. It was as if they were being eaten away. Mozart's ship landed there on the fifth year of his journey. I suppose it was inevitable he would go to the last church at some point during his voyage. Everybody at some time in their life at least considers religion, and Mozart was no different.
He left his ship at the spaceport and went to the city of the Supreme Temple. Over the next few weeks, he had many meetings with the priests who ran it. They were pleased to receive him, as they were all people. But, of course, in Mozart's case, they made a special effort. He was a prince from a kingdom in a part of the Ring Empire where they had few churches, and he was looking to enlighten his whole people. With his patronage, they could convert many new worlds to the true cause. "What cause, miss?" Edmund asked. "Did they have Buddha and Jesus and Allah?" "No," Denise laughed, running a hand through her newly shortened hair. "Nothing like that. You have to remember the Ring Empire was a very old civilization. They were long past believing people who claimed to have spoken to God or to be related to him or to have been sent on a divine mission to enlighten his universe. I'm not even sure church is a very good translation for what the last church represented. It was a kind of evangelical physics, really. Unlike all our religions, there was nothing in their doctrine that was contrary to scientific fact. No way their teachings could be weakened as people learned and understood more about the universe. Instead, they were a product of that same learning that had given the Ring Empire all of its fabulous technology. They worshipped, again, if that's the right word, the Black Heart of the galaxy. The children drew in breaths of astonishment. There were a few nervous titters. "How could they worship nothing, miss? You said the heart of the galaxy is a black hole." "I did," Denise agreed. "And that's what it is. A huge, great hole into which everything falls and from which nothing ever returns. It's already eaten millions of stars, and one day it will finish devouring the whole galaxy, but not for billions and billions of years. That's why the last church revered it and studied it, because finally all that will be left of the universe is black holes. They will consume galaxies and superclusters alike. Every atom that ever was will be locked inside them, and then they'll merge, eventually into one. And after that," she teased. "What?" It was a frantic cry from over a dozen small mouths. "That's why there was a last church, because of the uncertainty. Some of the Ring Empire's astrophysicists said that at the moment when the black holes unite and become one, then a new universe will be born, while others claimed that it's the end of everything forever. The last church wanted people who believed that after the unification would come a new universe. You see, as everything in this universe would be absorbed by the black holes, they thought they might be able to influence the outcome. Matter is crushed to destruction inside a black hole, but the last church believed it is possible for energy to maintain its pattern inside, either by inscribing it on the crushed matter or as some independent form. They wanted that pattern to be thought. Souls, if you like. They wanted to send souls into the black heart so that when the end of time came, and the neat order of physics and time fell into chaos, there would be purpose. Now, as you can imagine, this appealed to Mozart. The sheer worthiness of the concept dazzled him, making sure that existence itself continued. It was something to which the kingdom could devote itself with vigor and enthusiasm. It would also appeal to Indolian, he thought. But then he began to have doubts, the same kind of doubts that always threaten religion, no matter how rational its basis. Life is a natural product of the universe. To believe its purpose is to artificially impinge upon the end of time is a huge article of faith. The more he thought about it, the closer the last church's gospel seemed to be taken from divine intervention. Their very first physicist priest had made a choice, and in his vanity wanted everyone else to agree with it. Mozart wasn't sure he could do that for himself, let alone his whole kingdom. For all its grandeur, life is small. To expend it all on a mission that may or may not be necessary in hundreds of billions of years' time was to demand just too much faith. A life in the service of the last church wouldn't be spent wisely. It would be wasted. That wasn't what Indolian wanted. Once again, Mozart returned to his ship and left the first church planet to continue his voyage. He rejected the last church's abstract spirituality just as firmly as he rejected the city's devotion to materialism. Denise looked round at her little audience. They weren't quite as enthusiastic as they had been when she told them about the wonders to be found in the city. Hardly surprising, she chided herself. They're too young to be preached at.
Sometime soon, she said in a low, awed voice that immediately gained their attention, I'll tell you about the Mordiff planet and all of its terrible, tragic history.
The Mordiff planet was another of those legends of the Ring Empire that made the children shiver with chilly delight every time she mentioned it. Thanks to the vague hints she'd dropped, it had taken on the form of a particularly aggressive hell populated by well-armed monsters. Which wasn't quite a fair description, she thought, but for using as a boogeyman threat to get the garden tidied up at the end of the day, it was just about peerless. After work, Denise took a tram up to the Newmarket district of town. A 20-minute ride, moving slowly away from the substantial buildings clustered around the marina and docks, out into the suburbs, where the roads were broad and the shops and apartment blocks had flat, unembellished fronts. Long advertisement boards hugged the street corner buildings, no longer screen sheets but simple paper posters. Side roads showed long rows of nearly identical houses, whitewashed concrete walls, scabbing and crumbling in the humid, salty air, small gardens overflowing with ferns and palms. She got off a stop from the enclosed mart she wanted and walked. There were no tourists here, just locals. She strolled casually, taking her time to look in shop windows. The bars that were open all had tables and chairs on the pavement outside. Their patrons preferred the inside, where the lighting was low and the music loud. A scent of marijuana and redshift lingered around the darkened doorways, thick and sweet enough for her to imagine it spilling over the step like a tide of dry ice. As she approached one, a triad stumbled out into the bright sunlight, blinking and shielding their eyes while their slim wing shades unfurled from gold nose bridges. They giggled with the profound scantiness that only the truly stoned can manage. Two men in their late 20s, large manual workers of some kind, judging by their overalls, and a woman. She was in the middle with her arms slung around both of them. Not much of a figure, not terribly pretty either. Her tongue glistened in the sunlight as she licked one man's ear, shrieking with delight. His hand closed on her rump, squeezing hotly. Denise stopped abruptly and turned away. Despite the sunlight and humidity, her skin was suddenly chilly. She cursed herself, her weakness. It was just the combination that had caught her off guard. From her angle, two men dragging the woman off. Incipient sex. Laughter, indistinguishable from cries. Idiot, she raged against herself. There was a wild impulse to slap herself hard across the cheek. Knock some sense into you, girl. Would have done it, too, if this wasn't so public. It was crazy that her body could be so strong while her mind was so feeble. Not for the first time, she wondered if Raymond and Joseph had asked for subtle neurochemical alterations to be incorporated into their modifications. Human psychology was highly susceptible to chemical manipulation. Could you get a drug for cool? The triad wobbled away around a corner, and Denise started walking again. A couple of deep breaths and squaring her shoulders tautly returned her traitor body to equilibrium. A curving glass roof ran the length of the mart, branching out in a cruciform shape a third of the way down from the entrance. Inside, the air was conditioned, scrubbed of moisture and dust. Open-fronted shops had speakers blaring out music and amplifying the spiel that the owners shouted without pause. At the front, the majority of shops were protein knitting, taking raw protein cells from the city's food refineries and blending them with various hydrocarbons and baseline compounds to produce textual approximations of original terrestrial food. There were greengrocers with colored globes purporting to be fruits and vegetables, butchers with burger steak approximations of every animal from sheep to ostriches, fishmongers with glistening white slivers of flesh on crushed ice, shops with fresh pasta, new-baked bread, rice, curry, cheeses, chocolate, specialty teas, and coffee. The smells were enticing as she walked past. Plenty of people loitered, haggling over portions, testing their consistency. Denise made her way to the back of the mart where Likeside Bikes had their shop. Like every bicycle shop in the universe, it had a small front area cluttered with bikes still in their wrappings, while a counter partitioned off a workshop full of tools and small boxes of spares. There were three main work areas, centered on elaborate clamps that held the bikes at chest height. All of them were occupied with machines in various states of assembly, with mechanics working on them. Cycling was a popular mode of transport in Memu Bay, and business was brisk. The assistant manager, Mihir Sansom, looked up and immediately abandoned the child's bike he was working on. "Hi," Denise flashed him a bright smile. "Has my order come in yet?" "I believe so." Mihir glanced at his two colleagues and gave Denise a twitchy grin. She kept her gaze level. It was almost a rebuke. Mihir cleared his throat. "I'll check." He went back into the workshop and picked up a box from his workbench. "Here we go. Front suspension pens, 5 sets. "Thank you." She put cash down on the counter, separating the notes into 2 piles. Mihir made a show of swiping the box's strip into the till. 5 notes went into the cash box. The larger pile was deftly folded and slipped into his pocket without his colleagues seeing. He put the box into a carrier bag and handed it to Denise. As she walked back down the march, she allowed herself a small smile. Mihir wasn't the greatest actor, but the bicycle shop with its autoclaves and catalytic bonders was incredibly useful. The risk of his activities being noticed was tiny, and even if he was queried by his colleagues or the manager, they'd just assume it was some kind of illegal scam he'd got himself involved in. That was the beauty of every cell-structured underground group. Outside of the command group, nobody knew anyone else. Even if the worst-case scenario came about and the authorities became aware of a cell, they'd only be able to close down that one unit. Taken by itself, the items Mihir had produced for them would mean nothing to the police. He'd probably be able to describe Denise, but as far as he knew, she was just a courier. He'd been recruited by members of another cell, who had been given the information that his cousin had died during the last invasion. After skirting around his sympathies, they'd ask him if he could help out making life difficult for the next occupation force. It wouldn't even cost him anything. The movement would be happy to pay for his trouble. Once he'd agreed, the only contact he had was through encrypted packages containing the specifications of components, and Denise. Had it been a normal radical movement, then they would have used a low-level courier to collect the box. This was a little different. Indigo Data scrolled across her site as the Prime and her Pearl Ring trawled the data pool for real-time police messages. There were hundreds of them. The majority, simple routine contacts and location monitors. There were even some special investigation branch operations, none of it related to her. Even so, she kept an eye on her fellow pedestrians, noted the few cars and vans parked along the street, watched the cyclists. None of them seemed interested in her, except for a couple of lads. But then surveillance operatives wouldn't show an interest. It was recurring faces that she was hunting for. Only 2 people got on the tram with her. She switched trams 2 times before she finally arrived at the workshop, confident no one was following her. It was one of 12 identical workshops in a 2-story block designed to accommodate light industry. The whole place had a fairly dilapidated appearance, with windows covered up with reflective shields or wood panels. A faint whine of air conditioning sounded along the narrow, deserted street that led to the rear loading bays. Piles of discarded packaging were accumulating by several of the roll-up doors. She'd never seen anyone put rubbish out or a city council crew collect any, but the size and position of the piles changed on a weekly basis, so someone else used the workshops. Denise asked her neural pearl to check the workshop's security network, which reported that the perimeter was secure. She waved her left hand over the lock sensor and pushed the door open. It was a large concrete walled room inside, empty apart from a long wooden carpentry bench they'd set up in the center and a metal storage rack that took up 1/2 of the loading bay wall. Both windows and the roll-top door had been bricked up and reinforced with carbon webbing. Joseph was already sitting at the bench, milling cylinders of stainless steel on a programmable electron beam lathe.
Did you get them? He asked.
Hope so.
She dropped the box on the bench and broke the seal. 2 dozen black cylinders spilled out.
They both started examining them.
Mahir had produced slightly conical tubes of boron-beryllium composite, 10 centimeters long. The narrower end was open, while the base was sealed with a small hole in the center and an outer ridge.
Denise wondered if he knew he was producing bullet casings. The shape was obvious enough, though the high-strength composition could be misleading.
Not bad, Joseph said. He was measuring his casing with calipers, the liquid crystal display blurring as they closed around the base.
Not bad at all.
He's got the dimensions within spec.
I'll start filling them, she said. The casings were the last component. They already had the bullets, the caps, and enhanced explosive. Combined with the rifle they'd assembled, a single shot would be able to punch clean through skin from over 2 kilometers away. The rifle was just one of the weapons they planned on using. Other weapons and booby traps were being put together by cells across Memu Bay. Innocuous little components locking together into lethal combinations. This time, when the invaders arrived, the resistance movement would be there and ready to make life hell for them. Platoon 435 NK9 had to wait in the base's transit lounge for 5 hours. Lawrence didn't mind that for himself. The lounge was air-conditioned. He had a memory chip loaded with a good multimedia library. The drinks machine was free. Mission time pay had begun that morning. Squatty heaven. He stretched his legs out over 3 chairs and relaxed, while the big departure sheet screen kept repeating the same messages about their scheduling delay and mechanical service requirements. Somewhere out across the hot runway, teams of mechanics were peering quizzically into the inspection hatches of their assigned space plane, trying to find which one of the 50,000 subcomponents the AS pilot was bitching about. AS pilots monitored every component parameter constantly, running the results against International Civil Aerospace Agency performance requirements. Lawrence had heard that operating companies often rebooted their vehicle electronics with AS programs downrated from the manufacturer's primary installation, allowing a degree more flexibility when it came to determining flight worthiness. The letter of ICAA's law equaled huge maintenance costs. If a ZBAS pilot wanted repairs before it would fly, Lawrence was very happy to have the procedure carried out. The space plane would definitely need it. The enforced hiatus didn't sit so well with the rest of his platoon. Worst hit was Hal Grabowski, the youngest member, just past 19 years old. Hal's flight experience was limited to 1 subsonic transocean flight to Australia and 5 short helicopter trips during the last phase of their training. He'd never been on a space plane, let alone experienced freefall. Space flight was a novelty he was hungry for, prowling around the lounge in search of some sign that they could embark. A sure giveaway that he'd never seen active service before either. The ancient armed forces maxim, never volunteer, had streaked over Hal's head at near orbital altitude. It's been 3 hours, the kid complained. Fuck this. Hey, Corp, if they don't fix it, will they give us another space plane soon?
Yeah, I expect so, Corporal Amorcy muttered. He didn't even glance up from the screen on his media player card. Hal's arms flapped about in disgust. He stomped off to annoy someone else. Amorcy looked up, watching the kid's back, then turned and smiled at Lawrence. The two of them shook their heads in unison. Amorcy was a good 10 years older than Lawrence, though his thinning hair was the only outward sign of aging. He was very careful to keep in shape, spending hours each week in the base gym. Good physical condition was a non-negotiable requirement ZB placed on all its Strategic Security Division squaddies. Amorcy was never going to rise above corporal. He had neither the stakeholding nor the connections. It didn't bother him. The position meant he could take good care of his family, so he worked hard at maintaining it. That worked to Lawrence's advantage. Amorcy was the most reliable corporal in the Third Fleet. Only his face betrayed the time he'd devoted to the front line of ZB's
asset realization policy. A wide patch of skin at the rear of his left cheek was slightly chewed up, where a Molotov cocktail had burned through his helmet 15 years earlier in the Shuna campaign, before his skin reached anything like its current level of ability. Even that shouldn't have been too visible, not with the dark ebony color of Amersey's skin. But that day, the 3rd Fleet Field Hospital had been inundated with casualties. At the end of a 22-hour shift, the trauma doctor was too fast applying dermal regeneration virals. They'd done the job they were designed for, infiltrating the corium layer to implant new genetic material that would build his epidermal layer back over deep char ridges. Unfortunately, the genes that the virals carried were tailored for a Caucasian. Half of Amersey's cheek was white, resembling some kind of flat tumor. Amersey allowed rookie squatties to have one joke about it. Hal, naturally, had made a second. The kid was taller even than Lawrence, topping out over 2 meters with muscles that could match a skin suit's strength. It didn't make any difference. He'd limped for a week after landing badly. The kid had shown the corporal plenty of respect since then. It was about the only lesson he had ever learned properly in the whole 9 weeks since he joined the platoon. "Are there going to be any stewardesses?" he asked Edmund Orloff. "You know, some decent-looking pussy." "It's a fucking military flight, you dipshit," Edmund sneered at him. "Officers and management get free-fall blowjobs. You get to fuck Carl." Carl Sheehan lifted his head, blinking his eyes open. Tiny colored silhouettes shivering over his optronic membranes shrank to nothing. He gave the pair of them the finger. "What about the starship?" Hal persisted. "Any chicks in the crew?" "I haven't got a fucking clue. And even if they were all female, it wouldn't make any goddamn difference to you. Crew only ever get the best. That means their fucking coffee machine is smarter and more attractive than you." "Aw, man, that is such a waste. I mean, how many times does a guy have this kind of opportunity? The way I figure, I'll see 6, maybe 7 campaigns. That'll give me a total of 14 space flights. I don't want to waste none. That's criminal." "Waste them how?" "Boomeranging the padding, man. The big free-fall free-for-all. A mid-air rodeo." He clenched his fists and held them up, pleading. "I want to have sex in zero-G, man. Every unnatural position you're not built for. Holy shit, I get hard just thinking about it." "Shut up, you arrested pervert. There's no such thing. The whole idea is a myth dreamed up by corporate publicity back when they started flying orbital sightseeing tours. Get it? You even twist your head around fast in freefall and you throw up. You start tumbling around the way you're thinking of and every orifice lets fly. And I mean every. Now forget about it and give the rest of us a break." Hal backed off, looking wounded. Edmund was the closest he had to a genuine buddy in the platoon. The two of them had broken base curfew enough nights to go cruising the Cairns Strip together. Lawrence waited silently, hoping the kid would finally shut up. There were 10 other platoons waiting in the lounge with them, all of them hyped with the prospect of the flight. It wouldn't take much to start a fight. He didn't want to start ordering the kid about before the mission had even taken off. None of the others were such a pain, but then they were older. Half of them had families, too, which acted like a damping rod on wilder aspects of their behavior. And all of them had seen duty together. Hal walked over to one of the big picture windows, pressing his face against it to look eagerly out at the huge space planes that were managing to take off. He took a swig from a Coke can. "Hal, stop drinking now," Amersey said. "You don't want any fluid in your stomach when we go into orbit. You'll throw up even if you don't twist your head." Hal glared at the can. He dropped it and kicked it in the direction of the nearest wastebasket. There was no other form of protest. The kid would do all right, Lawrence decided. He just needed guiding through the first few crowd encounters, and he'd start to learn caution. Pity he didn't have a steady girlfriend. That was always a calming influence. But at 19, he was only interested in screwing as many girls as he could impress by his muscles and his credit card. 4.5 hours into the wait, and the departure's sheet screen changed their flight status to boarding. Hal let out a loud whoop and snatched up his small bag. The rest of Platoon 435 NK-9 lumbered up out of their chairs and made their way over to the designated gate. Their space plane was rolling slowly into the departure bay as they assembled at the clearance desk. The Shianti 5005H3 space plane was a well-proven commercial ground-to-orbit vehicle. The Beijing Astronautics Company had first flown the original 5005A Mark in 2290. Since then, there had been over 40 variants produced as the manufacturer gradually expanded capacity and smoothed out early bugs. The 5005H3 was a stretched delta planform 120 meters long, with a wingspan of 100 meters. 80% of its volume was taken up by fuel tanks. Its carbon-lithium composite fuselage had a broad center section with graceful curves, blending it cleanly into the wing section, a softness in sharp contrast to the knife blade leading edges. A third of the way down the belly was a single oval scoop intake with an air spike protruding several meters from the rim.